I'm Chris Voss. I'm sitting here with author Andrea Avery talking about her new memoir, Sonata, a memoir of pain and the piano. She's all the way in from Phoenix, Arizona to come sit here and chat with me about her book. Andrea, thank you so much for coming by WCRB to chat.
Thank you for having me.
This is a coming-of-age memoir, in particular your life with rheumatoid arthritis and your love affair with the piano and with music in general, and then with Schubert. And we're going to get to the piano bit and the Schubert and the music in a bit. But I thought we'd start off talking about what is rheumatoid arthritis, what is your particular strain of rheumatoid arthritis, and how does that sort of differ from my grandfather's arthritis?
That's a great question, and I appreciate your asking it, because rheumatoid arthritis is a disease in need of some better PR, I think. It has the name arthritis, and so people associate it with a geriatric illness or a wear and tear kind of orthopedic, you were a football player in high school and you have a bum knee kind of thing. So an overuse kind of mechanical illness. But rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease, and while it has mechanical manifestations, it's really more akin to multiple sclerosis or lupus or fibromyalgia or, you know, some of these other more systemic diseases. So what happens in rheumatoid arthritis is something triggers a reaction in your immune system to make it freak out and overreact, and it begins a kind of multi-site assault. And the primary site of those that assault is the joints and the linings of the joints, and that's where you get the arthritic symptoms that you would recognize, joint pain and stiffness and swelling. But as a more systemic disease, it can affect many other tissues and systems. There can be complications with your heart. There can be complications with your eyes. I've been lucky not to have too terribly many of those complications. But it's a serious and really profoundly crippling disease that more people suffer from than you might know. My experience of it was a little bit unusual in the sense that while there is a juvenile form of arthritis, I actually was very proud to get the adult version early. So I got an adult onset rheumatoid arthritis, which people would expect to see in ages 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, but I got it at 12. And even then, and still, I'm a little bit kind of perversely proud of the fact that I got the kind of unabridged adult version a little bit early.
And it sort of hit you right as you were coming into your own as a pianist.
Yeah, and you know, that's not atypical also for juvenile arthritis or rheumatoid arthritis, that it corresponds with a period in your life where your body's changing a lot, puberty. So there's kind of these hormonal changes. But, you know, around age 12, 13, 14 is often where a person is starting to kind of make the bridge from a thing you're pretty good at as a kid to a thing that could be a viable occupation or a course you could chase for real. And so rheumatoid arthritis landed in my life when I was kind of at that tender spot where piano is what I love and it's what I want to do. But wait, seriously, like college, could I really? Is it really something I could do? So it's kind of an unfortunate convergence of extraordinarinesses in my life.
I love how the book is structured. It's structured like a classical piece of music in movements, and each movement sort of goes through a different part of your life, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And the first movement being sort of joyful and childlike, and then progressing.
Yeah, and I picture it sort of it gets kind of dark in the middle, and maybe, but then I think hopefully it emerges into a more jubilant kind of movement at the end, which, as you know, many, many multi-movement works do.
I wanted to have you read a little bit from the early bit of the book, from when you first came across the Schubert,
yes,
21st Piano Sonata, the B-flat.
Okay, fantastic. In 1991, at the conference in Providence, Rhode Island, I'd attended an art therapy session for us kids with arthritis, which was actually just a stack of construction paper, Elmer's glue, crayons, and tape left in the middle of a folding table in an otherwise empty banquet room where someone in an Arthritis Foundation polo shirt stood nearby and didn't say or do anything. I'm not saying it wasn't therapeutic. I cut and glued and colored silently alongside other arthritic kids. A boombox in the corner was set to a classical music station, and a piano piece caught my attention, and I boasted to anyone who was listening, "I can play this." I'd never heard it before, but I loved it immediately. It began with a far-off melody in a middle register, a major key melody that sounds like someone absent-mindedly humming a snippet of a remembered song. the melody lifts and falls to a pause as the hummer remembers more and more of the song. Then there is an ominous rumble from the low end of the piano, a note that doesn't really seem to fit. And the melody returns in a minor key, and the rumbling turns into triplets in the left hand against the right hand's eighth notes. I needed to know what this music was and who wrote it. People sometimes say that a pair of shoes in a department store or a puppy at the pound spoke to them. That's what this was. I needed to get it home and try it on, nuzzle its neck. At the end of the piece, the announcer said it was Schubert's Sonata in B-flat, D960, and I committed that all to memory the way I'd committed Tony McComas's phone number to memory when he gave it to me after Sunday school one day, and I made a mental vow to get the music and make good on my boasting.
Did make good on your boasting.
I did. That instance of boasting. There's plenty of boasting I've done in my life on which I have not made good.
But the Schubert has been with you throughout your life,
yeah,
still to this day.
It's kind of I don't know what to call it. It's this accompaniment, which to use, you know, once you start paying attention to the way that musical terminology is in all of our other language, so it's been my accompanist. Yeah, I chased that sonata as the piece I wanted to play and to cultivate and you know, mainly so I could just sound like that. I mean, what musician doesn't listen to music and think, I want to be like that? So I wanted to sound, initially, I wanted to sound like what I'd heard on the radio. But that piece of music, I experienced it differently than I had any other piece of music. Before that, I was, you know, pretty good at getting a piece of music, learning it, performing it, getting a prize or a ribbon or whatever, and moving on. But this one wasn't so easy to move on from. And it also wasn't so easy to... I couldn't make it sound the way I wanted to. There was this internal version of how I wanted it to sound and then what my hands were doing. And I found that with that piece of music, I needed to kind of study it more. I needed to listen and I needed to look at the manuscript and I needed to just kind of pore over it. And unlike other pieces that I'd sort of brashly cultivated and developed ready for performance, this one I kind of wanted to stoke and keep a little more private. I kind of maybe sensed that once you share it with the world, it's not completely just your own anymore.
Well, and it's one of Schubert's most deeply passionate and almost sad pieces of music in its happiness.
Yeah, and that I didn't know till much later. You know, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about it as a piece of music or its spot in Schubert's catalog or in his life writing it until much, much, much later. You know, I approached it as a piece of piano literature. And it saw me through kind of the fizzled end of my piano career. And then it became a piece of history to study. And when I was writing this book, to go back to that sonata and to ask a different set of questions, why did this sonata speak to me when I was an ill child in a banquet room in a hotel in a city named, of all things, Providence? I mean, that's unbearably beautiful. When I learned that he was sick and dying as he wrote it, when I learned how it was regarded after his death by scholars and how it was sort of, you know, snobbishly disregarded. And then when I learned about sort of theoretic analysis of it, Joseph Strauss's book, Extraordinary Measures, and his analysis of that sonata as a kind of a musical treatment of disability that isn't resolved a la Beethoven, that isn't kind of fixed and made triumphant and recovered from, but disability that's accommodated and a piece of music is built with this harmonic kind of disability in it. I thought, oh my God, you know, 20 years ago I heard this sonata and I thought it was just a piece of music, and now I'm learning that all this has been written about it and said about it, and it's a parable for me. And that's what makes that piece of music bearable to listen to, even though sometimes other piano music is really painful for me to listen to, because that same itch I had at that table in that conference of I can play this, I can inside, but my hands can't. But that piece of music, because of all this history and all the Schubert that goes around it, I still listen to it for comfort.
You talk about a lot of artists and musicians in the book that sort of like like the Schubert, have sort of an analogous story to yours. Do you feel that there's in musicians like Leon Fleischer, for example, or Byron Janis, who have this disease that affects their playing, that they can achieve something different through the music, and that you hear the music in the way that they hear the music?
I don't know. You know, that's a tricky question, because I don't know any of those pianists personally. I've never gotten to, as much as I've, you know, I've sent fan letters to Byron Janis. He hasn't written me back. So if you're listening. but I would love to, you know, in his biography, he talks about how, you know, he kept his arthritis secret for a long time, and he didn't want to betray the music by letting anyone know that it was produced by or created by an arthritic pianist. Because there is a tendency then, if you're a disabled musician, for this kind of discounting, this, well, that's pretty good for an arthritic pianist, or for someone with equipment that's damaged to make. And I know from his biography, having read that he didn't want that kind of qualification to be attached to the music he made, even though he did it with an arthritic body. I don't know if there's a kind of a subtextual pain and painfulness and then reception of pain that we kind of damaged pianists can hear in each other's work. I think there are certainly there's technical things. If your hands don't do the same things, you've got to figure out different ways to finger passages. You've got to figure out different ways to, you know, hold or transition from fingered chords or whatever. And I can't say that when I listen to piano music created by someone like Leon Fleischer or Byron Janis, I'm thinking, oh, I see what he did there to accommodate the lack of mobility in the third finger joint. You know, I'm not thinking that. And I think if you are thinking that when you're listening to music, you're doing it wrong, you know. So I don't know if there's a kind of a subtextual, almost like a radio signal that gets beamed out from a pained pianist to another. I do know that I hear piano music differently, I think, now that I can't. You know, a pianist tends to finger piano music on his or her jeans or tabletop, when I think you were doing that when I was describing the Schubert. Actually, I think I caught you. But my hands can't do that anymore. So that kind of keening, how would it feel to play this, has to happen all invisibly internally for me. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It absolutely does. And I think it actually transitions nicely into the second reading I would like to have you read, if you don't mind.
I would love to.
This is from the middle section of the book, which is much more pained and raw in the way that you go through this transition in your life from a pianist aspiring to then no more.
Yes. As graduation approached, I reflected on my old childhood hero, Mozart, and the end of my own formal piano study. After falling for Schubert, I'd retired Mozart, stuffed him away like a plush toy I'd outgrown. But standing on the edge of adulthood, I longed for my old comforts, Huggy, childhood Mozart. That last public concert of Mozart's, in which he played the piano concerto in B-flat, it was on March 4th, 1791, my birthday. To a girl born on Vivaldi's birthday, that's the kind of thing that feels like a sign. Then again, according to musicologist Alfred Einstein, Mozart's playing of the piano concerto in B-flat, why is all of my favorite music in B-flat, signified the end. It was not in the Requiem that he said his last word, however, but in this work. I graduated with a degree in music. That summer, my remaining music friends and I fled to the beach in Los Angeles for the week. In the company of Beth and Deanna, these two extraordinarily beautiful and talented saxophone players, one jazz and one classical, I felt like an imposter. I feared they saw me the way Wittgenstein's contemporaries saw the one-armed pianist, or, for that matter, the way many people view disabled people. Courageous, curious, freakish, feckless, virginal, vexing, pious, pesky. I knew my friends loved me and admired me for whatever limping music I was able to make against the odds, but I'm fairly certain they didn't see me as what I wanted to be, a pianist. I was unable to find solace or inspiration in Wittgenstein, or for that matter, in any of the other legendary musicians persevering despite disability stories that I knew of. Beethoven? Sure, he was deaf, but that happened gradually and didn't start until he was in his late 20s, at least. He at least had a chance to get great before he started slipping. And there was Leon Fleischer, who lost the use of his right hand to dystonia in the 1960s and simply plugged ahead, playing all the left hand alone repertoire and conducting, which I hadn't been able to manage, until Rolfing and Botox delivered his right hand back to him. I should have been able to derive some inspiration from Byron Janis, himself a sufferer of arthritis. But Leon Fleischer, Beethoven, and Byron Janis had been granted something I envied. They had at least been given the chance to be great. Byron Janis's head start on arthritis was so much longer than my own. No one could dispute his greatness. He could always point to what he'd done and say, "Do you hear? That's me. All I have is a box of ribbons and trophies, a photo in a yearbook."
That moment in the book stuck. I think I closed the book after I read it because it is such a powerful discussion about your, okay, you've come to, you wanted this thing so badly.
Yeah.
But I was a singer before I came to do this radio thing. And when I sit in an audience and listen to a singer, I can feel my throat doing the things and missing it a little bit. Do you play piano at all? Do you sit down and tinker? Do you have the ability to do that?
Well, that's a question with a lot of different answers, and it's very variable. If you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would say, yeah, I tinker and I can play, and I not like I used to, and I choose different, you know, repertoire, and you know, suddenly Bartok is a lot more interesting to play because even though it's, you know, it's not flashy, I can use my brain and I can communicate between my brain and my fingers, and I can do something. Right this second, the answer is a no, but not a forever no. I had a joint replacement surgery 2 summers ago in my shoulder, and had a complication intraoperatively. I had a nerve injury, and so I lost all use of and sensation in my right arm, and so I could not lift a cup. I could not pinch. Paralyzed for all intents and purposes. I spent that whole summer with a book called Handwriting for Heroes, learning to write with my left hand again. And so it's been 2 years since that event, almost to the day. It was June 30th, 2 years ago. And I still don't have sensation in two of my fingers on my right hand. And because my hand was immobilized because of the nerve injury for 6 weeks, I lost some range of motion in all the other fingers. Because rheumatoid arthritis is very much a don't use it, lose it kind of disease. And so having my hand sort of on the injured list that stretch of time, I haven't quite bounced back from that yet. So right now, I can't do much of anything at the piano. I don't think I'm ready to say that it's over for goodsies. I'm totally silenced. I went to a dance performance a month or so ago that was featured Japanese dancers in middle age and American dancers in middle age. And it was the product of a piece of scholarship that a women's studies professor that I know and who I love and who helped me with this book a great deal, Rose Weitz, had gone as a sort of an attaché to this with these dance professors to Japan to examine the way that middle-aged Japanese dancers are treated and regarded in Japan versus middle-aged dancers in the United States. You know, dance is another field where your shelf life is
you hit 30
short, right?
Yeah.
But they'd begun this research project to examine how that was regarded differently in Japan, and then the culmination of it was to bring these Japanese dancers back to the United States and have a performance. And one of the things that I think one of the Japanese dancers was quoted as talking about was that you cannot quit dancing. She had been attacked by a dog, I think, and had to stop dancing for a while, but she said she danced even with her fingertips, just to be doing something, because if you let it go, if you stop, you'll stop. And that kind of horrified me because I was sitting in this darkened dance hall thinking, I haven't touched the piano in months. I've stopped. And if I've stopped, I'll stop. And so I started really thinking that I should maybe take that piece of advice. And if one of my fingers can do something, if my thumb can strike notes in succession, I should probably do that. Because I'm a little bit concerned that if I stop, I'll stop. And I'm not ready to let that go. I had an excerpt from the book Run in the Washington Post last week. And it got, I guess, I don't know what the word is, maybe syndicated. Or another newspaper ran it today. And of course, they put their own headline on it. And the headline that this paper put on today said, "A young pianist's dream dies," or something like that. And I couldn't resist. I commented. There's one comment. It's me. And I said, I hope you read the book to find out that the dream isn't dead. It's transposed or it's transformed or it's whatever. I'm not ready to say it's dead. It's a little bit more like my playing the piano has been abducted, and I don't know if it's dead or alive. I don't know if it will come back to me. I don't know if it'll look like or sound like what I remember when it comes back to me. And you can see why that would put you in a painful you know, if you have a child who's been carried off, being around other people with children would be painful. But it's this great, tender combination of both despair and hope. I'm not ready to say it's dead. That would be a closure, and I could get past that, but I'm not silenced entirely yet.
Do you feel you play in your head?
Oh, I do, and I have piano playing dreams all the time, which are wonderful because I get this. I wake up to having had this experience, this tactile, auditory experience, but then also to discover that it didn't happen. Or, I mean, once music is done being played, it's just an idea anyway. So, if I played in my dream, it echoes in my ears and in my head like a memory anyway. So maybe that's just as good. It's not just as good, but yeah, I do. I play in my head. I can, when I listen to piano music, I can sort of see it the way it would appear on the page. I still am very much a musician, but a musician who can't play music, I don't know what that is, you know? You're not an author if you read but don't write. You're a good reader, and those are super important, but you're not an author. I'm something in music based on the way I listen to it and the way I feel when I listen to it and how attentively I listen to it. And what's going on inside my body and my mind when I listen to it, but I don't think it's a musician.
Yeah, I might argue with you on that. The way that you write about the music is so aware of the experience of being the musician that it is musical. You even write in the book about your writing as being a musical experience.
That was the concession that, you know, to lose the piano is a grievous loss in my life. It's hard. And when I felt myself sort of transitioning to writing, I said to myself, the only way I'll be okay with not being able to play the piano is if I can write about it, and if I can write about it well, and if I can get my story out. And I wanted this book to become a book that other people could read, and that will be the only thing that will make it okay if I can't play the piano anymore. But if that dream were to sort of die or be, you know, hobbled, I think that would have been unbearable. So the writing about music is, and you mentioned it being written in a musical form to movements, it's still important to me to be a composer and to be musical. And so to be able to try to write about it in a way that made that come alive and was musical to readers was the only way I was going to be okay with not being able to play piano.
I want to have you read the last reading because you mentioned the movements, and the book does have that upturn at the end that is, I mean, happily ever after is a stupid phrase, but it is this, you know, acceptance of your life. It is what it is, and you're going to take it as it comes one day at a time.
I love my life now.
I love your life. I felt unfair talking to you because I was like, I know so much more about you reading this book. It's so open than you know about me. So I feel like we'll have to reconcile
for
that.
For now, we'll figure that out. Yeah. Get all your secrets out of you. Disease has changed me for good. It has formed my appetites and curiosities. I don't need to stalk my disease in operating rooms to see the full story, to understand it. It is always present. I cannot stand apart from my body. I am one thing, homogeneous, harmonious. It is me, and I am it. I am not my body, but neither is my disease. Arthritis shows up in my joints, but it is written into me at the most basic level. It's in my DNA. It is as much a part of the very fiber of me and as separate from the physical parts of me as my soul is. I am not afflicted. I am imbued. God is in the space between the molecules, and so is disease, and so is music. If music is in the spaces between the notes, then what happens if there are no notes at all? Can there be music? John Cage would say so. The absence of notes forces you to hear the music that is happening around you, despite you. Eventually, I brought Schubert in from the garage, but instead of playing the first movement, which had had a hold on my heart since I heard it in Providence almost 30 years ago, I turned to the second movement. This Andante Sostenuto movement in C sharp minor begins slowly, mournfully. I had time between key depressions to really hear the sounds, to plan where my hands would fall next. It is not flashy, but the 16th notes in the middle section in A major stopped me short. I could not simply sight-read it, not with these uncooperative, out-of-practice hands. But there was a flutter in my chest. This was not out of reach. If I could practice, truly practice, in the way I never much wanted to as a child, I could play this. I could not believe I had overlooked this achingly beautiful andante movement in my lust for the first movement.
You mentioned earlier, both in this and earlier, about the flashiness versus the being able to put your brain into that piece of music. How is, now that you're more moving more towards Bartok and that kind of stuff, how is that different for you as a pianist?
Well, I think it's probably, maybe, I don't know. I don't want to speak for other people, but I think it's probably a process that happens to people as they age in general. I'm thinking about those middle-aged dancers or actresses who no longer play the love interest. You start to realize that you have to invest in the more durable cerebral parts of yourself, that bodies, whether you have rheumatoid arthritis or a chronic illness or a disability or not, bodies wear out and change, but you can cultivate a self that just gets better. So there's sort of a contrary motion thing going on in my life where, sure, my body is, I'm probably even sicker than I was 10 years ago, but I'm also smarter and I'm more well-read and I'm more articulate and I'm more patient and I'm gentler and I'm more tolerant. And, you know, I hope that that continues. And it, so I think that I discovered early in my disease that kind of my brain, my personality, my ability to express myself were kind of impervious to arthritis to some degree, and also what people were responding to in me. And I didn't really want to cultivate those things. I wanted to be, who doesn't want to be young and cute and able forever? But growing up is a process of realizing that those quieter, more durable aspects of yourself are of more value. So I don't love flashy piano music the same way, even to listen to the same way I did when I was young. When you're young, I grew up watching like Ripley's Believe It or Not, and you know, reading the Kids Did It section in World Magazine. I was really interested in these feats of dazzle. I'm just less interested in feats of dazzle now as an adult. I'm interested in, you know, quiet, long-haul, durable contributions in the work I read and write and listen to. So I don't know how much of that is a product of illness or of my own kind of, if feats of dazzle were still possible for me, would I still be in love with them? Or have I sort of made that concession? I don't know. I'm middle-aged now. I'm 40 now. I'm just not as easily dazzled, but I'm dazzled by quieter things.
What do you hope that people will get from this book when they read it?
Well, I've been really gratified to get some messages from strangers on Facebook and through email and stuff. And just the other day I got an email from a man who was a guitarist who got Guillain-Barré syndrome. So it can be a disabling condition. And he told me that the book spoke to him and that he is playing and he's playing. I think he used some beautiful metaphor I wish I'd written myself about, you know, music. You put in the blender that is your brain and you let it come out the way it comes out, incorporating your bodily experiences and your emotional experiences. And if it doesn't sound the way the composer intended it, or the way it was written, or the way some other fabulous recording artist recorded it, that's okay because your rendition of it is informed by everything you've been through, and it's kind of more hard won than that. So just to get a message from a guitarist whose body has also made playing of his beloved instrument harder, but has made the music he makes on it richer, that's what I wanted out of this book. Was I wanted it to knit some of us together who are these musicians whose bodies have made our making music harder, but sweeter. But don't have to be a musician. If there's something you love and the path your life has taken you has imperiled that thing you love, the kind of fighting to keep it in your life, I want my book to reach those people too. And I want them to feel less alone. I wrote this book because a teacher told me you should write the book you want to read. I was writing terrible novels at the time. And I was kind of struggling and asked this teacher, like, I don't know where this is going or why I'm writing this. And he said, well, is that the book you want to read? You need to write the book you want to read. And so I wrote the book that I think would have consoled me when I was 17, picking a college and wondering at that point if I had to ratchet down my dreams or when in that dark phase of the book that you mentioned, when I kind of was sort of kicked out of music, it felt, this book would have been comforting to me. It's not a self-help book. It's not a spiritual book per se. It's not, it doesn't have tips for, you know, managing your illness. It has tips for managing your life when your body mutinies. And the truth is, all of us are either in that position now or going to be. I mean, if you age, your body's going to change on you and might change some of your dreams. Or if you become ill or disabled, you're going to have to renegotiate an identity that includes the things you love with a body that kind of changed on you. I want it to reach those people, and I want it to knit us together, and I want them to continue writing to me to tell them if it did, because that has made this 10-year road with this book. And as you remember, the book is my way of being okay with not playing the piano. So when someone writes to me and says, your book spoke to me, that kind of chips away at the deficit of piano in my life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for swinging by the studio and saying hi to me and chatting about your book. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Chris.